surely don't need to tell you.
Has it really changed your life?
You let somebody drill into your
It's okay, everyone. It's just a slight change in music, and it scared me too a little bit. So we're back, and to tell us what's on the show, our new presenter is about to open her mouth for the first time and make a wonderful impression. So no pressure at all, Kate Monaghan.
Was that the big introduction we were talking about earlier?
It's what you deserve, for the moment.
Oh, harsh. Anyway, on this month's show, Refreshing Attitudes, we'll be downing a glass of beer for the sake of disability positivity and asking, what is good awareness raising?
And would you come on a disability show to talk about not being disabled? Well, almost certainly not, because we wouldn't let you. But Sally Gardner is the exception. She's a children's author with dyslexia. She'll be chatting to us a little bit later, and she hates the word disabled. Hates it.
Ooh, interesting. And right at the end of the show, our music comes from Danny Lamb, a disabled artist who's travelling the globe and composing songs in every city he visits.
And after the wonderful voice who tells you who we are, I'll introduce you to the two guests I've got sitting in front of me.
Ouch! Disability Talk from the BBC with Rob Crossan and Kate Monaghan.
And look at this, sitting to the right of me, a brand new presenter.
Well,
it's
hello.
Kate. Hello.
Hello.
It's wonderful to have you on board. Is there anything we can do to make you feel more comfortable? Cheese toasty? Massage?
Yeah, all of the above. I'm looking forward to the beer later.
Oh, yes, that's right. Cerebral. We now realise that CP stands for cracking pints rather than cerebral palsy. I know this is what everyone's going to want to know. What is your disability? Go on, get it out there.
I'm so glad you asked.
Yeah, because it's not remotely uncomfortable.
No, it's never uncomfortable to talk about, is it, albino over there?
Everyone knows that.
Well, I've got Ehlers-Danlos type 3, which is hypermobility type, which is basically a kind of arthritis, and it affects all your joints, and it means you dislocate quite easily, and you fall over a lot, and all of that kind of stuff.
When was the last time you dislocated something?
I have a feeling I dislocated my ankle yesterday, but you get used to it. And
it's that common. It just happens.
Yeah.
And you just, wedge the bones back together again?
Yeah, I did a really embarrassing stumble out of a church service I was attending, fell out, and everyone rushed around, and I kind of went, oh no, my ankle's out. And then I kind of very subtly popped it back in again and was like, it's fine, everything's fine. And then you just grin and bear it.
This is like the opposite of hypochondria, isn't it? For most people who would be screaming and wailing, and you're just, oh, well, you know, maybe just a cup of Earl Grey and a crunchy bar and I'll be fine.
Don't look at me anymore. Thanks very much, everyone.
Is it the topical bit? Should we do the topical bit?
Yeah, let's do the topical bit. So the first 20 minutes of every show is where we chew over recent events and try to make sense of disabled life as we see it this month. So helping us with that today, we have two guests who both have a bit of a link to autism.
Right, so we've got Robin Stewart. Hello,
hello.
Robin. Hello.
Hi.
Now, you're on the autistic spectrum.
That's right.
Somewhere.
Yep.
Whereabouts? Beginning, middle or end? Higher, middle, lower?
Well, it depends how you think about it. Officially, my diagnosis is Asperger's syndrome, although that diagnosis technically doesn't exist anymore, but luckily people will not be getting undiagnosed. It just means that people won't be now diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome.
Why? Is this sort of disability purgatory that you're
why are people not getting diagnosed with it?
Well, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual is the big book of diagnoses. Now, autism is not a disease or an illness, and it's not a mental illness, but it's in this book with psychiatric disorders like psychosis and depression and anxiety disorders, simply because that's where psychiatrists and psychologists go to look up diagnoses. And now they're simply saying that people are going to be diagnosed with being on the autistic spectrum, and there are three different levels.
John, you are sitting across from me over here. Tell listeners why we might have brought you into the studio today.
I guess my claim to fame. That sounds awful, doesn't it? I've got an autistic son.
That is a strange claim to fame.
Yeah, it is. It is. But one that we should shout about a bit more. But I write a blog called My Son's Not Rain Man.
Nice.
Which is about him. And just trying to dispel the myth that he's certainly not a genius. Let's put it like that. He's brilliant in lots and lots of ways, but he's never going to be a genius. He's got two little special skills and things that I talk about. I've mentioned one in the blog, and I mentioned one. I've also written a show about our life together, and I mentioned one in the show as well.
Oh, go on, tell us one now. Something that he's awesome.
One is your 2p. You know those 2p machines.
Those what?
The 2p machines in an arcade.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Push penny things.
Oh,
brilliant at them. So he can walk up to one of them and he can tell which one's going to pay, and he can put the 2p in, and he can make at least 34p.
Wow.
And stuff, so, you know.
And how old is he?
He's 11.
Okay.
And have you brought him up in a 1970s seaside?
That's where we holiday.
Sounds like where he should be living. You could clean up. That's your pension right there.
The glamorous life of a
single
parent.
You know there are some where they have 20
pence. I was going to say, you need to move up to the 20p machines.
No, we keep them away from the 10p machines and things. They're just, we don't touch them. You just look at them from afar.
Wow.
Okay, so now last time you were in, Robin, we spoke about the Brit Gary McKinnon. And this is the guy with Asperger's syndrome, for anyone who's forgotten. And he hacked into NASA and the Pentagon. Now, the US wanted to extradite him, but I remember there was all these many, many years of fighting, and eventually the UK Home Secretary chose not to comply. She recognised his Asperger's and depression and said it would be incompatible with his human rights to allow the extradition to take place. And I don't know what your feelings are, but with this case, it was sort of popularly established, I think, that people on the spectrum can be uniquely talented in computing. And I know at the end of May, there was this German software company called SAP, or SAP, and they started a recruitment drive for people on the autistic spectrum. The CEO, Luisa Delgado, said that SAP believes innovation comes from the edges, and she added, "Only by employing people who think differently and spark innovation will SAP be prepared to handle the challenges of the 21st century." Robin, do you think that she's right in saying that?
Well, I think that it's really important not to almost typecast people on the autistic spectrum or sort of stereotype us, that there are lots of people on the autistic spectrum for whom this kind of job wouldn't be suitable, either because they're not interested in IT or that they don't have the skills to do it, but they will have the skills to do something else. But I do think that innovation does come from difference, and I think that for too long people on the autistic spectrum have been seen as just being somebody with a disability, and that's it, full stop.
So what do you think those skills are that people with autism have then?
I think maybe it's helpful more to look at core skills rather than kind of areas like computing. So, for example, lots of people on the autistic spectrum have incredibly long memories, have great attention to detail, incredibly trustworthy and honest, that people on the autistic spectrum can really be people that think outside the box, that you might think that that's kind of goes against autism, but...
So how do you think that helps in the computer world then? Why do you think that these software companies are thinking that actually people with autism will be particularly good to work for them?
Well, certainly for software testing, I've done software testing and I hated it, but I know that lots of people do really enjoy it. You basically, where I worked, I was working in an insurance company, and I had a list of essentially fake insurance quotes and claims, and I had to input them into this insurance software and then write down into a database what the result was, what the software said, i.e. yes or no to the insurance claim. So to do that, you've got to have a lot of patience. You've got to be happy to do something over and over again that's very samey. You know, there's not much variation. Have great attention to detail. So really be able to see if you're trying to spell a surname or something. Then you've got to make sure that it's correct. But also, I think that not seeing the bigger picture in that particular task is very helpful. Because if you saw the bigger picture, you'd think, you know, there's six other people doing this exact same thing. We do maybe 50 of these a day, maybe more. And, you know, it's just kind of going around in circles because that stuff goes to the coders who have sat across from us in the office, and then it will come back to us and then we'll do the same thing all over again.
John, I mean, what do you think about this? Would you like to see more companies in Britain taking on these attitudes?
I kind of like it, but I can't help thinking it's a little PR.
Really?
Thing, to be honest, and just like, I think unless I'd like to see more, know a bit more about it, and know that there's a long term plan to support people in the work. But I think that's the key thing, is it's not just offering the jobs, it's putting the support in them once the jobs are in place and things. So it's offering a structure for when the job gets stressful, when you've been doing the job for 6 to 8 months, 12 months, 18 months, it's very easy, I think, to offer jobs left, right and centre and say we're going to do this. But unless there's a real support structure in place to help people fit in and to help people get along, then I'll start believing it. I mean, it's got to be a good thing. It has. Being a bit cynical.
Do you think you can see your son kind of going into a path like that? And do you think he kind of thinks differently to other people and might bring something different to the table when he grows up?
I think he does. And I'd love nothing more than to think that at some point in the future, he'll control his behaviours, shall we say, to a point where he'll be able to hold down a job. I'd love nothing more. And I think computers do hold a fascination for him because they don't. And I think it is that consistency. People change. I change. You know, I'm moody. I'm irritable. He can't judge me. A computer will tend to do the same thing for him. And I think he gets comfort from that. Whether or not it means he wants to spend every day doing it, though, there's a dangerous stereotype in people, isn't there,
I think, with it.
And I think that's what Robin was saying a little bit as well, is that, you know, not all autistic people like computers.
Yeah.
Now, one thing you noticed that you said earlier, Robin, was that to say people with autism are very trustworthy and honest. So does that apply to your son? Is he a bad liar? And if so, yeah. Why are autistic people bad liars?
I think because he doesn't see the point in it. I don't think he sees a purpose. There's no point in lying because it doesn't. I just don't think he's
commendable attribute.
Yeah, no, it's brilliant. It is, and it's one of the easiest things to deal with. Is that, you know, I know that if he's done something, he will. He's got no qualms about saying he's done something because it wouldn't cross. It wouldn't even enter his mind to lie about it.
Now, you know, we're sitting here in the studio, and to your left, you have a real life adult next to you who is on the autistic spectrum.
Can you wave for us, please? Fully functioning adult. There's Robin waving.
Yeah. Now, this, to me, feels like a very good opportunity. So, as a father of somebody on the spectrum, is there anything that you would like to ask her that she might be able to help you out with?
Do you know what? I've always said that people who come and visit my blog, my favourite are always adults with autism. Because I think they're just a forgotten voice all the time. And people forget that children will one day grow old and that my son will one day grow old and stuff. So I think people like Robin talking about their condition mean more to parents of autistic children than you realise. So thank you for that, Robin, first of all.
My pleasure.
And then the question... do you know what? It sounds really twee and really... But I think my big question would just be, are you happy? As a parent, that's all we want for our kids.
Most of the time. I think that an able-bodied person wouldn't... Oh, that sounds wrong, doesn't it? Able-bodied. Somebody without...
No, it doesn't.
Without, I don't know...
Non-disabled?
I don't always know the terminology. Somebody...
Don't worry about it.
Someone without autism, I don't think that they're happy all the time because I think that there are things in life that, regardless of whether you're autistic or not, that you come across that they don't make you happy and you have to live through them. So I should imagine that my level of happiness is probably just the same as somebody that doesn't have autism.
Wow.
Can we flip it over then? What about you, Robin? What would you like to ask John about being a dad of an autistic son?
Well, actually, funnily enough, the same question, really. Are you happy? Do you enjoy being a dad?
I love being a dad. It's been the best thing that... it's an old... Every parent says it, don't they? But he is. He's everything. He has his moments, I'll be honest. But he's all I know. That's the other thing as well, is that, you know, you talked about how autism is all you know. He's my only child, so I don't know any different. He's all I know parenting to be.
And you wouldn't change him?
It's not my decision, is it? It's his. And things, it's not... If it was up to me, I'd take away the anxiety, I'd take away the pain it causes him. He has cerebral palsy as well. I'd take away any of that in an instant, like any parent would. But in terms of whether... It's his decision. And I hope that I can bring him up, that one day he'll turn around and say, I'm happy with what I've got.
Thank you. Wow, that was a very interesting moment there. Thank you. We really appreciate it.
Move him onto the 20p penny pusher machines. Yeah. Seriously. Clean up, mate.
So we want to delve into the gender divide now. This October in Leeds, there's a conference about young women and girls on the autistic spectrum. And Robin, you're speaking at it, and you have
That's
a book
right.
out
I
on
do.
The subject too.
Yeah, in September, my book comes out. It's about women on the autistic spectrum and safety.
So some of the subjects on the agenda are teaching social skills, preparing for puberty, plus sex and relationships for women with Asperger's syndrome. What are some of those differences, Robin?
I think the key is that when you teach about sex and relationships, that just teaching someone that being a teenage parent is bad and how to put a condom on a banana. Those things aren't really helpful.
Why
are we sniggering? I can't help it because I remember it happening at school and I laughed then and I'm 35 and I'm still sniggering.
Still,
what's wrong
when
with
someone
me?
Says condom, I can't help
no,
it.
No, it was the banana bit. I'm you're not going to put it on a pear, are you? So, you know, it makes perfect sense. Anyway.
When I was at school, I just felt like sex education, that wasn't going to apply to me because I was used to being called a spastic, a retard, a reject. And I just thought, well, no one's ever going to want me. That the only people that I'm ever going to get on with are like my parents' generation, and they're going to die. So when they're dead, no one's going to want me. And anyway, I won't want to marry someone from my parents' generation because there's too big of an age gap for me anyway. I mean, I think that, you know, no one ever talked to me about, for example, picking up that if somebody is like massaging your shoulders and your neck, that's, you know, that's kind of something that happens, you know,
as a come on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And no one ever talked about the idea of what it really means to relate to someone sexually or expressing feelings through sex. And those things are something that lots of young women probably pick up from their friends within their peer group. Mm. But if you're somebody who's socially isolated, then that's the kind of information you're not going to pick up from your peers. But also it means that in some ways you're more vulnerable to predators because you don't have that network. But also because you so want to be accepted. You want people to love you and want to be with you. And so if some guy says that, then you're going to listen to them. And this, I know that this doesn't just happen to people on the spectrum.
Is it different for boys then, John? I mean, I'm just going to bring John Williams back in again for a second. Because I mean, I know your son's school, there's almost no girls at all.
There aren't. And I think it's much harder for women on the autistic spectrum. I think they get a much tougher deal. Everything seems to be geared towards... I think it's because people's perception is that it mainly affects boys and things. But it's true. My son, it's a very small... special school that he goes to, but there's no girls in primary, for example. There's two girls in the secondary.
And why is that?
And I guess it is because it is more prevalent in boys, I think.
Diagnostically.
Well, this is it. This is the thing, isn't it? There's this whole argument over whether or not... I think it's much harder for girls to get the diagnosis in the first place. Yeah.
Well, why is that? We were talking about this in the production meeting earlier. We were thinking, well, if you're a little boy, you've got loads of cars, toy cars and things like that. And if you're, you know, lining them all up and not actually playing with them, that's a kind of a sign. But I guess a girl wouldn't have those kind of toys. What do you think? Is that realistic?
No, I'd agree with it. I remember someone telling me that a lot of the diagnostic tests were written by men and are geared towards the male of the species, if you like, and the women tend to lose out.
So the tests, you're quite right, they are written mostly by men thinking about the way that a male would process the world, I guess. There are some gender differences. Women and girls on the spectrum tend to hold back in a social situation and then watch everybody else and copy them. But also, quite often, women and girls, this can happen in boys and men as well, but they'll quite often, particularly during school, go through the day and hold in their emotions, and obviously it can happen at work, you know, hold in all the stress, and then when they get home, they kind of explode. It's probably more noticeable in children, simply just because there's the family around, but often as an adult, so as men and women, that can be particularly challenging. And you know, there's quite a high proportion of people on the autistic spectrum who also have coexisting mental health conditions.
Well, it's a very interesting topic, and our lovely podcast chums, if you'd like to email us about this, please do. Our email address is ouch@bbc.co.uk.
But don't call me chum, because otherwise I won't read it. Just out of respect.
You can call me chum, I like it. Anyway, thank you, John and Robin, both for your insight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Who is Kate Monaghan?
I am a 29, almost 30-year-old girl. I'm not a woman yet, I'm totally not a woman, who lives in London. I am originally from the West Country. For a living, I make TV programmes, usually around the subject of disability. I feel very lucky to be doing what I love for a living, so it never feels like going to work, so I never have that sad feeling on a Sunday night. I'm a Christian. I go to a very awesome small church. I'm a weird Christian. question because I'm gay and I have a girlfriend called Holly. I'm a kind of person who thinks that disability is very interesting. I like talking about it. I like debating it. It would be great if disability wasn't interesting because then it would mean that we were the same as everybody else in the world. But until that time happens, we should be having all the really difficult conversations about what's acceptable, what's not acceptable. I think difference is what makes the world go round, and everyone's different and everyone has something.
Ouch Talk Show.
Coming up.
Cause lately I've been feeling so taken by the simplest thing.
That's Danny Lamb, and he'll be playing us out at the end of the show.
And joining us now is author Sally Gardner. Hello, Sally.
Hello.
And now, your latest book, Maggot Moon, which both Kate and I absolutely loved.
We've been loved
reading over
it.
The weekend.
We've been raving about it all morning.
Now, I know it's aimed at young adults, and it's led you to win the rather prestigious Carnegie Medal, the Costa Children's Book Award, and it seems like you've been winning prizes ever since your first book, which I believe is called I, Coriander. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Came out back about eight years ago. Now, the slight elephant in the room here, I suppose, and the reason why we've got you on the show today is that you're dyslexic. I hope you don't mind me revealing that to the audience. But you hate labels like disability, and that's the kind of thought which it seems that drove you to write the book. So before we go into that, tell us a little bit about Maggot Moon, first of all.
Maggot Moon is... I wanted to write a book in a way, the way I see things. And I started to write him as a boy called Standish, Standish Treadwell. And through that character, I began to find what I wanted to say and be able to sort of describe the world in a way that I sort of see the world.
So you created this character as a sort of conduit, I suppose.
Yeah, in a way. He sees things very visually. And he has a huge imagination that really is propelling him out of a terrible situation that he's in. And it's through this imagination that he finally is going to find a way, hopefully, to get everybody out of the situation they're all in.
One of the things that I found really interesting was the way that I think you wrote the book and then you gave it to your editor. And it was your editor who pointed out to you that Standish was dyslexic. But it appeared to me it was obvious from, you know, the very first page of the book that this character was dyslexic. I mean, did it not occur to you that he had dyslexia when you were writing him?
Nope.
I mean, how is that possible?
I just wanted to write like I saw. I got this thing in my head that I just wanted to say it as I saw the world. And I thought he had a really quirky way of looking at things. I really liked that. I thought, yeah, that's great. It's a bit like me. And then the Coca-Colas was definitely, you know, yeah. I remember from my childhood, because I could never read the signs.
So tell me a bit about, tell me how you see the world and what is this Coca-Cola thing for people who haven't read the book?
Well, I couldn't read anything. I mean, I didn't read till I was about 14. And so the world of words was really just magical. I loved words, and I used to collect them. I would collect very complicated words. And so I had a huge vocabulary, except I couldn't say some of them because I'd get tripled over them. But we were never allowed to drink Coca-Cola. It just come in to England. We were not allowed to have it. And it was the one word over Piccadilly Circus. It came up and it was lit up.
Yeah.
And I thought it said Croca-Cola because it used to have, if you put a tooth into, you know, Coca-Cola, it would dissolve. And I thought it must be made of crocodiles. That's why the tooth got eaten, because it got crocodile juice in it. And hence it was called Croca-Colas. I was incredibly disappointed to find out, A, it had nothing to do with Croca-Cola, you know, nothing to do with crocodiles. And B, that
I think
it was,
we're all disappointed about that.
Yeah.
And B, that it was called Coca-Cola. Oh, anyway, so that was one of them. But there were many things like that for me. I mean, I remember I used to go to church a lot, and we had to say the Lord's Prayer. And I was always convinced that it meant there was art in heaven. And I thought, well, it was a jolly good thing because there was very little art in my life. And I thought it was jolly good to know that at least if things didn't work out down here, there was art in heaven.
So do you think you see things quite... Is it quite a visual thing rather than, you know, you trying to interpret the words in front of you as something different? Do the words move around? How is it that you actually see words on a page?
Well, for a dyslexic person, it's there's no glasses that can put this right. So it's very hard to know it's sort of a bit like being visually impaired. You don't know you are. You don't know what it's like to fully see. And that's a bit what it's like to be dyslexic. Because in a way, for me, words ripple. They go like wiggly-wiggly along the line. For some people, they stretch. Other people, they go blurry, out of focus. And some people, it just can go black and the words can actually start falling. So there are levels of this. And for some people, it's just a minor fuzz right. that makes the words jump up and down. But basically, these words are not staying stuck on a page. And the information between the words and your brain isn't getting through. And when I'm very tired, they all squeeze together. And I can't actually decipher the line, where the line of it goes.
Now, you hate the word disability, don't you?
I loathe it.
Yeah. And you believe dyslexia is a gift because it helps you see the world differently. So it seems a bit puzzling to me because if I was to give a gift to somebody, if I had that power, I would probably not give the gift of dyslexia. I don't know. And would you like to give this gift to other people? Would you actually impose it upon somebody else because you think it would actually improve their lives?
Oh, yes, definitely. I think it's an amazing thing.
Now, a lot of people would find that really difficult.
I understand that. And I have to justify this by saying I still can't fill in forms. I still have huge problems and I go to a bank and someone says, you just fill in that. And I go into an almost cold sweat and feel sick and think, how am I going to do this? There are ways round, I've learnt. One of the tricks, and they're tricks. But what you're asking me is, would I give this gift? And why do I see it as such a gift? And really, it's given me, I had to work through so much to get where I am. And it's a really hard gift to unravel. But ultimately, you can do it. If you've got the determination, it's really there. And it's an amazing ability to see in more than just 3D. You can see in layers of thinking.
And do you think it helps for younger people who are reading your books to see dyslexia as a gift? Because it might be hard for an 11, 12-year-old who's coming bottom of their class the whole time to see it as a gift rather than, actually, it's just this really difficult thing that's holding me back.
I think the thing is about dyslexia, everybody could be included in education. And in a way, it's the education's fault that it excludes.
Yeah.
And that is my big bone of contention. If we started to educate, in a more imaginative way, more to the right-hand side of the brain, more visual, more multisensory, we would incorporate so many people that at the moment are on the periphery. Our education is, and with the new government thing, is going to remain left-hand accountant education. Mm. And the amount of people that actually fit that little tiny bracket are thin and few and far between. And the rest of us are all on the outside. And I'm just asking that education should open up and embrace all.
And it seems like the world you describe, and for anyone who hasn't read the book, it's a very dystopian society, but it seems to be quite based on the 1950s. There's lots of capital punishment in schools. There seems to be this obsession with this Orwellian-style bureaucratic government of getting a man on the moon. And it seems like it's quite a left-handed, left-sided world you've created as well. That was intentional, I suspect.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And is it more of a exaggeration of what you see around us now in 2013?
Definitely. I mean, it is I think we also have to be very careful what we put into schools. And I feel very strongly about politicians saying what we should learn, what our children should be taught. And I don't think they have the right to do this. I think it should be teachers who are teaching children, not politicians. And I think, you know, where does the line of propaganda, where do we draw the line?
Did you mean corporal punishment in schools, not capital punishment?
I did, yes. Corporal punishment.
Corporal punishment.
That's what I should have said.
I sympathise with it because actually there is a moment where it does rather go into something else in my book. So you
that's
could
much
actually
further in. Yeah. I'm right on both.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the book does remind me of The Hunger Games in quite a lot with the whole capital thing. Anyway, Dragon's Den star and entrepreneur Peter Jones talked about his feelings of dyslexia recently. And we've just got a clip of this to play. And he's talking about Chris Dawson, the CEO of a chain of discount stores called The Range. And he's talking about the world of business. But I think his views on dyslexia are quite similar to yours. Let's have a listen.
The fact that a multimillionaire owner of a massive retail empire left school with no qualifications and without being able to read or write was not a massive surprise to me, because I'm partially dyslexic, but didn't find out until later in life. Research claims that us entrepreneurs are 5 times more likely to have the condition than the rest of the population. Dyslexics tend to struggle in mainstream education, but they flourish in other environments.
That was a clip from his series Peter Jones Meets, which has just come to an end on BBC Two. What do you think about that?
I think it's so correct that it's almost painful. And when he says they flourish outside school, I mean, actually, I would consider my life started when I was 16 and I went to art school. And I would almost say that was the day my world began. And up to that point, it was purgatory. And finally, somebody understood me. And I went from the bottom and I zoomed to the top.
Now, I gather you were speaking to our producer at the end of last week and the subject of Braille arose.
Oh, yes.
As a possible workaround for dyslexia. Now, one of the Ouch team, Emma, who's here with us now. Hello, Emma.
Hello.
She's got some Braille for you. So when we're reading, the problem with dyslexia is, as I understand it, it's a sort of eye to brain thing rather than sort of understanding language. So I think what we're trying to think about is whether touch to brain might actually be a different way of kind of interrupting those problems, I guess. So, Emma, do you want to have a go?
Well, okay, well, let me show Sally the Braille. Right, so
this is just one piece of quite ugly brown retro paper with lots of dots written on it that we've got in front of us.
Yes, and the ugly brown paper is something we all still use, and it's the thickness that's the important thing.
Sally, why don't you have a touch and see what it feels
like? If you
like.
Look at this top line here, what do you think this top line here is?
The finger is cursing over the
page. Oh, my word. That I mean, I wouldn't even know where to start.
If I show you the way I would read it. So.
Oh, you read it like that?
So now I'm putting two
index fingers.
Two index fingers.
So you start with this one, and then you move, and then this one moves after it.
So Emma's fingers seem to be skating over the top, whereas Sally's sort of massaging. rubbing the little
So
bit.
I'll tell you...
Is that my name?
Yes, well done.
That's
top
my
line
name.
Is your name. And if you notice the shape of it, you know, when I think of your name, I can see... whatever, feel that shape in my head. So I can feel S.
That's my
A-L-L-Y.
Didn't you change your name, Sally?
I did, but I can see... This feels like Sally.
Really?
Yeah, it has a sort of Sally feel. It doesn't... I was called Sarah, and I really hated the H. And this has got a lovely sort of... It's got... The S is a bit funny, because it's not got so much wiggles to it. But the other fit feels a bit... Yeah, yeah, I like it.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
Wow.
And this book, Maggot Moon, which we both enjoyed so much, it's quite scary as well, isn't it? Yeah. It's aimed at 13-year-olds.
Yeah.
And I'm a bit worried that a lot of 13-year-olds would be utterly terrified by it. Is this a warning that people should heed?
We've had the Carnegie shadowing group. And lots, 16,000 reviews on the shadowing site for the Carnegie. And some of them are so touching and they're so confused of, or I loathe this book. I absolutely, it's rubbish. Or I really love this book. It's the best book ever. And so I think it has many different reactions. People have different reactions to it.
I think that's what you want, isn't it? You want a bit of Marmite, otherwise.
A bit of Marmite, it's definitely.
Are we going to see Standish again? Do you intend to write to him again?
No. I think Standish was a one-off, and he ain't around anyway to write any more about. So, I like one-offs. I think they're very powerful. I think if you have to do a series like Hunger Game, I'm afraid you just have to keep making them near die and then live, near die, then live. Mm. And I really thought you've just got to be brave and run with the character.
So there is no prequel. It stands alone.
It's
Maggot Moon.
No prequel.
Well, thank you so much for coming in, Sally.
Thank you.
We really have enjoyed it and appreciated your time. And Sally's book, Maggot Moon, is available from all good bookshops. And we've got more details, as ever, on our website, bbc.co.uk/ouch.
Who is Rob Crossan?
Well, being a kid and having albinism, I rather enjoyed it. I was always quite a forthright, cocky little child who teachers on the whole utterly loathed. I really liked the fact that being an albino, first of all, got me out of loads of trouble. And believe me, there were plenty of times when I blamed my behaviour on the fact that I'm upset about my albinism, and I was that emotionally manipulative at about the age of 7, which really doesn't paint me in a very good light at all. But it did get me out of lots of trouble. And it also got me loads of attention, and I loved the attention of it, and I was quite happy to turn it on its head and do all the things that people didn't expect me to do. I was always given the choice of not playing sports, you know, but I really enjoyed it. I just did whatever the hell I wanted to do. Cycling around dark country lanes outside of Ellesmere Port as a kid with no bike lights, no helmets, and just not being able to see a thing. I'm really grateful to my parents. They could have mollycoddled me, but they were quite happy to let me go out into the world and figure out for myself what I could and couldn't do.
The Ouch Talk Show.
How many disability awareness campaigns actually break through and bring new understandings and, enlightenment? I mean, how good are charities at promoting themselves and, by extension, I suppose, promoting disabled people who they're supposed to be representing?
Well, a recent survey by NFP Synergy, sounds very exciting, found that almost 8 out of 10 people couldn't name even one disability charity. Now, I find that astounding, don't you?
Yeah, wouldn't Comic Relief count?
That's not a disability charity, surely.
What about the Send Rob and Kate to Elope to Barbados charity as well? I mean, that's quite well known.
That is a disability charity, and I think that needs more fundraising.
Well, apparently this was over 1,000 people were questioned, and they couldn't even name one. So with us to kick this around a bit, we've got Dan Dufour from The Good Agency, who specialises in the marketing of good causes. He's in the studio with us now. Hello, Dan.
Hi there.
We have Daniel Masliar, who's the head of PR at the disability charity Scope. He's on the line. Hello, Daniel.
Hi there.
And we have an old friend of the programme, Lawrence Clark, comedian, and I have to put this on the end, comedian with cerebral palsy. Hello, hello, Lawrence.
Hi.
So I'm going to come to you first, considering I labelled you so succinctly there, Lawrence. When it comes to awareness raising, I mean, how good do you actually think disability charities are?
Well, I think I'd agree with your introduction, Rob, in that do we actually want awareness in the first place? It just sounds kind of meaningless and passive. For example, I've got awareness of the only way is Essex. Doesn't mean I pay any bloody attention to it, but I've got awareness.
Daniel, what do you think about that? Because you're obviously your head of PR at Scope. Isn't awareness very important for you?
Yeah, awareness is very important for us. I think I totally agree with Lawrence. I think this shouldn't just be about awareness, though. Awareness is kind of a means to an end for a charity like Scope. And that end, like Lawrence says, is all about actually getting people to think differently about disability and think and act towards disabled people in a way that makes this world a better place for disabled people. So I think you need to move on from awareness possibly and actually talk about the public's attitudes towards disabled people. And I think there's a real need right now to have a broader debate about the way the public thinks about disability. You know, we had the Paralympics last year, Seb Coe saying that we'll never look at disability the same again. But the disabled people that we speak to at Scope really regularly are painting a slightly different picture 1 year on. Seems like attitudes are actually hardening. And I think we need to understand better, you know, why the public think about disability in the way they do, and then really think about how we can change that. So I think it's bigger than just awareness.
So I'm going to come to you now, Dan, with The Good Agency, who you work for. Now, I mean, is it a problem just with the lexicon here? Because, I mean, the idea of saying awareness, I mean, I don't want to be facetious, but I am aware that I have a disability. I am aware that Kate and Damon and everyone else working on the show has a disability. Does this awareness actually lead us anywhere? As Lawrence was saying, I mean, is it? How do we make it more meaningful than that?
I think I agree with Daniel. You know, awareness is one factor, but it's what you do with that awareness. Mm. It's one thing for people to know about you, but will they engage with you? So
should we call it something else then? Awareness raising seems somewhat of a sort of cul-de-sac.
Well, I think for charity, awareness is important in the first instance, because if people don't know who you are, they're not likely to support you. Mm. I think it's then what you do with that support. I think you need to encourage people to the charity, one, to support you financially. Mm. If you can't get people to donate to you, you're not going to exist. And if you're not there, you can't achieve anything. But also, in terms of that awareness, it's what you do in terms of policy and campaigning. You can use that power, use that influence to change for better policies, change for better laws, to make life more accessible for people with disabilities. So awareness in its own right, on its own, isn't going to achieve very much at all. It's how you harness it and what you do with it, I think, that's more important.
And what do you think that charities should be doing more of, or indeed less of, to try and promote themselves?
Well, I think for disability charities in particular, it's very difficult. When you look at the sort of the league, the, you know, the top 100 charities in this country, you've got to go quite a long way down before you get a disability charity. Unfortunately, there are other causes that have much more public awareness. So if you look at the top charities, you've got, you know, British Heart Foundation, cancer support, you've got children's charities, pet charities. It's a while before you get to a disability charity, which is a shame. I think part of the reason for that is there would be a disability charity for different types of disability.
Yeah.
So their market share then gets, you know, fragmented. Mm. But wouldn't it be great if they could collaborate more, come together more,
yeah,
to make a bigger impact, get more cut through?
Now, we talked about the Paralympics earlier on and Seb Coe, and he talks about this at length in his autobiography, which I had to read earlier this year for a newspaper. And I tell you, my kitchen table has never been less wobbly since I put it underneath it. But I do need to talk about whether we've sort of missed the boat here somewhat in terms of everything that was attempting to be achieved in the Paralympics, and a year down the line, is there a sense of anticlimax now?
I think the Paralympics was fantastic in helping to shift people's opinions. I think after that, there was a crest of a wave, and I really think that people were celebrating ability rather than disability, seeing what people could achieve, and I think that was a fantastic thing. And I really hope that after that, we may see disability charities come together, mm-hmm, and collaborate and mount some sort of campaign, joining forces to build on that. But I don't think that's really been the case, I think they've sort of lost the zeitgeist, as it were.
Do they cancel each other out then, some of these disability charities who are trying to go for the same kind of audience?
I think in some parts of the sector, possibly.
Which parts in particular?
I have to be careful what I say here. I'm thinking of my client base. But you do get some disabilities where there are multiple charities. So blind and partially sighted charities, for example, you've got Guide Dogs, RNIB, Action for Blind People, National Blind Children's Society. There's a lot of charities working in the same space and doing, when you look at it, very similar things.
Well, Dan, what do you think? Sorry, Daniel, with your scope cap on, would you like to merge with more charities to become a super charity?
I don't think it's about merging, but I think the point that Dan made about collaborating is absolutely spot on. If you look what happened amongst mental health charities, they came together a little while ago to do Time to Change, which was all about exactly this point. It was about them coming together, developing a really good understanding of what the barriers are to making people understand mental illness better. And they put on a united front to try and address some of those things. And I think that approach, you know, charities coming together to really understand what is behind some of these bad attitudes and working together to try and change them is exactly the right thing to be doing.
Lawrence, were you trying to say something there?
Yeah, it was. Firstly, we're canceling each other out. I think there's obvious examples there, like we have charities that campaign for inclusive education and then others that campaign for special schools. We have ones that campaign for independent living and then others run care homes. So it's not a consistent message. Also, though, I think in recent years, disability charities have had a bit of a quandary in that they can't portray themselves in the kind of tragic, pity me kind of way that they maybe did in the 70s and the 80s. But then there's a paradox, because if they portray us as having wonderful, fulfilled lives, that effectively they put themselves out of business, because why do you need to donate?
Yeah.
Well, let's revisit tragic and pity in a moment. But in the meantime, we mentioned this at the top of the show, and you may have thought I was just joking, but I'm holding it in my hand. I'm just going to tap it against the microphone so you know that it really does exist. And this is a half pint bottle of cerebral palsy beer. It's called CPA. Underneath it says CP for life. And it comes from Sweden. I want to try and describe, if I can, to you, the on the label, there's a person in a wheelchair on the front who I suppose has a cerebral palsy. It's not a photo, it's a rather crude black and white line drawing. And Kate seemed to think that it looked a bit like Lawrence Clark.
I think that's a compliment.
But I actually think it's a woman, first of all.
Okay, I said a female version.
She looks a little bit like Betty Boop, I think, actually. A very luxuriant mane of black hair, very skinny legs, arms kind of bendy in the CP
way. Come on, open it.
And
Let's break
a few BBC health and safety laws. And I'm going to do it away from the microphone.
Can I just say...
Oh, yes. Please do.
I've got water. How come?
Lawrence is at BBC Radio Merseyside rather than here with us, so I'm afraid he doesn't get to join in. But the bottle's open, so I'm just going to pour a little slug for Dan over there. You want to take
Thank
that from
much.
Me, Dan?
It's very dark.
And Miss Monaghan, would you like
you
a glass
me,
as well?
Can you pass me your empty one?
Do we have another glass?
I'd like to try.
Okay, right.
Despite not liking ale.
In. That is a bit of a disability in itself, if you're going to try it. And look,
really,
it's so frothy.
You really do have to have a look at this
I'm pouring it terribly.
Sure
I do apologise.
We will have a picture up of somewhere.
Now, before we actually toast, let me just tell you a little bit more about it. It's we wanted to get one of the representatives from this charity, which is called GIL, by the way. It's an independent living charity in Gothenburg in Sweden. We wanted to get somebody on the phone, but they weren't free, presumably because they're in some sort of alcoholic stupor. But the beer's interesting because they give it out to bars and restaurants who are accessible. So instead of getting a boring certificate you put on your wall, they actually give you a load of cerebral palsy beer instead, and it's kind of got a lot of people talking. They've got all kinds of campaigns going on, but obviously this is by far our favourites.
Yep.
So, without any further ado, shall we raise a quick glass?
Yep.
Cheers, everybody.
Cheers.
Cerebral
Cheers.
Palsy beer, how does it go down? Wait.
Oh.
Hey, that's pretty good. I think that's all right. What do you think, Dan? It's a bit warm.
It's quite strong.
It's very strong.
It's 5.8%.
Oh, my
it's,
word.
It's pretty flat.
That's not going to turn me onto ale. But Dan, Lawrence, Daniel,
hang on a minute, Lawrence.
Hold on, Lawrence.
Apparently it's horrible, so you haven't missed out.
Yeah, you haven't missed out. I mean, what do you think about these kinds of marketing campaigns? Is this the kind of thing that disability organisations in the UK should be doing?
Yeah, I think it's great, actually. It's a nice segue on from the point you're making before about what charities could be doing, because I think there is a real need for charities, and it's not just disability charities, it's all charities, I think, to be slightly braver. If you're conscious that the public isn't coming to your particular issues, isn't that aware of what you're saying, you need to go to the public. You need to go to where the public are and what they're talking about. And I think developing a beer and putting it in bars that are accessible is exactly the right way to be doing that. So I think maybe producing beers isn't something that we can do, but I think the principle behind it is something that we can learn from.
Lawrence, what do you think? What do you think we should be doing in terms of campaigning?
First of all, it is the idea that if you drink enough of it, you sound like me.
I only need another swig and I'm there.
One and she's anyone's, two and she's everyone's.
I was thinking then, because yeah, you're right, because typically whenever I see disability charities in the UK, it's normally on a bag that gets shoved through my letterbox asking for old clothes, which isn't quite the image that you kind of want to portray. I think they do need to up their game a bit.
It's not sexy, so, is it?
I like the idea of a beer because it's something that we all relate to and what lots of us desire. So maybe we could have cerebral palsy straws with the slogan, "We suck, our lives don't."
What do you think?
Just we suck.
Dan, do you think that could work?
I'm not sure about the slogan as a former brand manager, but I think both Lawrence and Daniel make great points. I think charities need to treat their supporters more like consumers.
Mm.
I mean, Lawrence was talking about some old-fashioned channels there, you know, people sending direct mail through the door or bags to be collected, you know, for charity shops. I think the more charities can innovate and treat their donors like consumers, the better.
But you say you're not sure about that slogan. Aren't we being too conservative?
It's
very funny. It's come from Lawrence.
I think that's part of the point. I think it's great that it's come from Lawrence and we can laugh at said it. I think it may have been different if I maybe had said it. Somebody that doesn't have cerebral palsy, yeah. I may have ended up with a slap around the face. So I think it's where it's coming from, whether the message is authentic.
This is one of the whole debates that has been going on ever since Ouch started. I mean, I love the fact that we can use this show to, I don't know, use terminology because it's sort of part of a club because we're disabled. But should that mean that non-disabled people can't make those jokes too? I mean, there seems to be this general rule that they can't, but I'd rather prefer it if they did, to be honest.
Can I cut in there? I think one of the things that was great about the Paralympics was that it did create an atmosphere where increasingly people were able to be slightly more open about disability. And, you know, take Channel 4 and shows like The Last Leg. They absolutely did try and, you know, sweep away some of the political correctness, I think, that maybe gets in the way when it comes to discussing disability. I think, and touching on what someone said earlier, I think it was moments like that that made the Paralympics such a breakthrough moment. And I think the trick now is to find ways. You won't get the Paralympics again. That was a one-off. But are there other ways, other spaces we can create where we can have a bit more of an open discussion about disability, where we're a bit less worried about tripping over political correctness? Because I think that is the start of changing the way people think.
Well, let's do this. I mean, next time we're here, I'll make sure I get a few more bottles of the CPA in and we can talk about the debate, you know, whilst a little bit more drunk, which usually loosens the tongue a little bit. So I'd like to say thank you so much to Dan Dufour from The Good Agency. Thank you, Dan. To Lawrence Clark up in Liverpool and to Daniel Maslier. Thank you to you all for joining us.
Thank you.
So that's it for show 98. We'll be back in August for a 99 with
a great big flake on
the side. So would I. And speaking of flakes, thanks to the team, Emma Tracy, studio manager Richard Andrews and producer Damon Rose.
But now it's time for some music. This month it's Danny Lamb, who's been travelling around the world. He started in Dublin and ended up in Izmir in Turkey and has been writing a new song in every city he's landed in. Now he's got spina bifida and wants to raise awareness of it. The song we're playing today, though, isn't one of those songs, but we gather it has become something of a spina bifida anthem in his homeland in Canada.
At last, a spina bifida anthem. So here it is, Danny Lamb with The Simple Things. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
On when you've nowhere to go, I know a place where the light's too close, and it's my beacon through. Today is meant for me and you to see. Sometimes we all need something to believe in, and you're cause lately I've been feeling so taken by the simplest thing. Lost without a voice, am I hope to find a way? We walk this road together, a dream of come one day. Taken by the simplest things.